through it. Last week in chapter 1, if you remember, King Ahasuerus had gotten merry. It means he got tipsy. And because he was drinking and gotten tipsy, he made the mistake of wanting to show off his queen, Vashti. They had just got done after 180 days of showing all his wealth, and then they had this party, and then he drank a little too much. And we know, we talked about last week, sometimes you drink a little too much, you make mistakes. Unfortunately, he should have just backed up and admitted he was wrong, but he was stuck. His pride got to him. He wants to display her. Well, she doesn't want to come. And she really was thinking right, but unfortunately, when there's laws, especially in the kingdom, you got to obey the laws. And so what happened was she was supposed to be obedient to the king nonetheless, and she refused. And so eventually, as you know, she was banished. They told her, you're out of here. You're not the queen anymore. So what happened was Ahasuerus really divorced Vashti, and they were no longer the couple. Well, somewhere between chapter 1 and chapter 2, we know that 4 years has passed. King Ahasuerus, remember why he was having everyone there in the first place, they were going to strategize about attacking Greece. And so somewhere between chapter 1 and when this event happened and what we're coming into now, he goes to Greece and they go to a battle and they go fight this war, but unfortunately, he and his ships that were in there got trapped in a place called the Saronic Gulf, which is over between Athens and Corinth. And the ships were there, and they got blocked in, and they said about 300 ships were captured or had sunk in that area blocking that gulf. And then what happened was they were overcome, and so he had to come home with his sort of his tails between his legs. He lost the battle. And so now he's returned home and he's come back. And we know that they say that Vashti was removed from her queenship in the year 842 BC or 482 before Jesus came on the scene. And then he left and he came back and then he comes and where we're at now, he comes and marries Esther in 478 years before Jesus comes on the scene. And we know that once he got married, it was only 13 years later that he actually was assassinated and put to death himself. So as we come into chapter 2, we're coming into how Esther came into the story. Last week was Ahasuerus and Vashti, and this week we come into Esther. Like I said last week, the book of Esther doesn't mention the name of God, doesn't mention prayer. Doesn't mention a lot of things that we normally see in a book. It's one of three books that speaks about women in the Bible. And one thing about the book of Esther that we've learned, if we learn anything, is that sometimes you wonder, where's God? And he's there. You just don't see him. You don't think he's there, but he's there. And he's working behind the scene. That's what we see in the book of Esther. And really, if you take a careful look at the book of Esther, it's really more about Mordecai than it is Esther. And what he does and what God has showed him and the decision he makes. But Esther is the one, the instrument that's being used to make these decisions in order to help spare the Jews and keep them from annihilation. So in verse 1 we come to, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. So whether this was before he left or just after he got back, when everything kind of settled down and he comes back, he remembered Vashti. It was like he was thinking, man, I want her again. But he made a decree that she was to be taken out, and he couldn't, once the king made a decision, it couldn't be reversed. And so he's thinking about her again, and he remembers what she did, and then probably remembers what he did. But unfortunately, a decree had gone out, and he couldn't have her back like he wanted to, but he wanted this companionship with her. And I often think about that sometimes. You know, right now my wife and I are going through a study with John Corson on marriage. And it's an interesting study that he's doing about marriage, and it says that if you're looking to do this to make your wife a better wife, or if you're doing this to make your husband a better husband, then this isn't the study for you. Because really the study is about getting a closer relationship with God, and in turn that will bless your wife or bless your husband. And we are enjoying this study that we're doing right now. And it made me think about that because I was thinking about this. What King Ahasuerus really needed was a closer relationship. He needed a relationship with God. He didn't have one. And we tend to think the physical relationship is what we need. You know, if you're single, you want to get married. If you're married, you're happy and you know it. I ain't going there. You should be happy and you should know it, right? But really, our relationship with God is what should bring us close to Him, and then it would bring us close to that mate, and then allow God to work with the circumstances out. But see, he's lonely, and he's looking for something, because our hearts are always looking for something, and really our hearts need God more. And sometimes He blesses us with a wife or a husband, and sometimes not. But He's looking, and so this is what they say, verse 2. Then the king's servant who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be brought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Susan, the citadel or the palace, into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given to them." So in Susan is the winter palace of the Persian kings. Susan, the palace, was actually built by Darius, the king, who built it and occupied it. After his reign, somewhere in that part, it got burnt down. I had a picture, but I couldn't put it up because it wouldn't come over to put it in here. But the ruins that were located of this palace, it's a trip to look at this thing. But then we come into Ahasuerus' time, and he actually helped restore this palace, and then he lives in it. And then Artaxerxes, of course, that Nehemiah was sent to rebuild the wall, he lived in this palace. So this was the winter palace of the kings. And we look at this time and what has happened here and what's happening, and we see that Hegai, the eunuch. Now, eunuch, if you don't know what a eunuch is someone who's castrated. That's basically what the definition of a eunuch is. In the scriptures, we read of eunuchs 39 times in the Bible. You can find it 39 times in the Bible talking about eunuchs. And it's in the book of Isaiah 56:4. And this word that they use for eunuchs is Cyrus or Saris. And it's an ancient word of the Hebrews. And the Hebrews did not practice castration amongst their eunuchs. And we know that in other areas they did. Egypt had eunuchs, Babylon had eunuchs, the Persian Empire had eunuchs, and ancient Rome had eunuchs. The Egyptians' royal servant Potiphar, if you remember Potiphar, the story in the book of, I don't know what book it's in, but Genesis with Joseph. I lost my mind for a minute there. Went blank. He was considered or called a Cyrus, meaning a eunuch, in Genesis chapter 39:1. I was thinking about that because when I read Matthew to you, you'll understand. In fact, I'll read it. There's three classes of eunuchs according to Matthew 19:12. It says, "For there are eunuchs who were born this way from their mother's womb, impotent. They were born like that. They just weren't going to have relationships." And it says, "And there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men," those that were castrated. They were men made it. And then he says, "And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake, and he who is able to accept this, let him accept." In other words, a guy would decide that he didn't need marriage, he didn't want marriage, he just wanted to serve God, and he wasn't going to ever have relationships. They just decided. And there are fellows like that. Their heart is to serve God. They know that, you know, according to Corinthians, when you get married, your not loyalty, but your thing with God kind of gets divided. You know, you serve God and you worship God, but now you got to take care of your husband or your wife. And so there's kind of a split there, and then things happen. Well, in ministry, sometimes when you want to give your heart and you just want no distractions, you just decide, you know what, I'm just going to serve God. That's my heart's desire, is to serve God. And being married, sometimes, yeah, you have to kind of take care of each other and kind of split that loyalty. And that's a bad word. I don't have one in my mind I can think of, but that's the idea. Well, Potiphar was said to have been a eunuch, and I was thinking, man, I wonder, we know he didn't probably, he wasn't born a eunuch, he was married to Potiphar's wife. We don't even know her name, it's just Potiphar's wife. But I was wondering if he didn't decide later, because of his wife, that he wanted to be a eunuch. And that's why she wanted Joseph. I mean, that's just my own little thing. I just like, but it's funny that they used that name for him, and I'm thinking he must have made himself a eunuch. He must have decided that he was just going to be loyal to his servitude. And so that's about the eunuch. In chapter 1, the wise men said to remove Vashti. The king said, what are we going to do about this? The wise men, the ones that know the laws and the custom, and they say, you know what? We need to get rid of her because of what she's doing. She's going to make all the other wives think they can do the same thing. Disrespect her husband, not listen. And remember, this is the culture at the time. I'm not saying it was the right culture. This is just the way it was. And so here in this chapter, we said that the attendant says to him after he gets back, and they probably see Ahasuerus kind of lonely, and what they say that he had to do is let the young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. So let's go out and get all the beautiful virgins we can find, and let's bring them before the king. Now, this was something that had been done before. He had a harem to begin with. It's not really a beauty show, okay? I know you might think that they're having a beauty pageant and whoever, you know, came with the best bikini won. That's not the idea here. It was that they were going to bring these women and they had to be virgins, which goes to show us the mindset of this king, okay? This isn't really a love story about a king and Esther. It's really about a guy who's kind of off and he wants virgins to have in his harem so he could have pleasure with them. That's the idea here. Well, they're going to bring these young girls to him, and they said the one that pleases the king, she will become queen instead of Vashti. So they wanted to replace it. And it says, this thing pleased the king, and so he did so. In other words, so they allowed it. They went for a search for the young women who would become the next king. And again, I really think what he needed was a relationship with God. I really believe that. But he's looking for his pleasure and what he can get. And it says, in Susan, the citadel or the palace, there is a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. So Mordecai comes into our picture. The son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, and he was a Benjamin. Mordecai and Esther are both from the family of King Saul, the family of Benjamin. That same line. Who is Mordecai? Well, first of all, his name means little man or humble man. That's what his name means. We know from this verse here that what he was from Susan. This is where he grew up. This is where he was born. We know from this verse that he was from the line of Benjamin, the line of King Saul. And we also know that we're going to find out that he also adopted and raised Esther. We know probably he was a lot older than Esther. We know that they were cousins. It says Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And you can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 24, where this event happened 114 years before where we're at right this day. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, and Hadassah is Esther's Hebrew name, and it means myrtle. They say that the myrtle tree or branches are a sign of peace and thanksgiving. I actually got online to look at myrtle trees, and it was kind of interesting. When you look at a myrtle tree, you look at their flower, they have all different colors of myrtle tree. Myrtle trees, they say, will bloom 3 cycles of flowers. I was thinking, man, I got to go find me one of these trees, man. That would be awesome. Because in my yard, we have different flowers. And they come in spring, and like my golden chain tree, it just looks like a plain tree. But every April, all of a sudden, you see these green things starting to pop out, and then they spiral And then they turn yellow, and the whole tree looks like golden chains coming off. And they only last for about 3 to 4 weeks. And once it's gone, they're gone. You won't see it again until next year. And I was thinking about this myrtle tree. I go, man, Lord, that would be cool to have a bush or something where it grew a flower, then they died off, and then another bunch came, and another one, just because I like flowers. And so it was interesting that this is what her name meant. It was a place of peace and thanksgiving. And it says, that is Esther. Now, Esther is her Greek name, means star. And what I found interesting was because some of those myrtle trees, they have a plant that looks like stars. It's a trip if you go online and you see these different flowers. So Esther, and then it says his uncle's daughter. So let me read that without my little commentaries. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. He adopted her as his own daughter. And, you know, I was thinking about this because of this time we live in. I know it's probably been like that forever, but taking someone in when their parents have passed away, or in our culture today with DHS and all the trouble that kids are having and parents are having and kids that are abandoned and all that, you know, there's a need to take in these young children and nurture them and care for them. And Mordecai does this, and he's probably a lot older than her, and she sees him as a father, but yet they were really cousins. But he raised her, and he trained her, and he did everything he could for her. It said in verse 8, so it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Susan the citadels under the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. So Esther, like many other young women, virgin women that were in the area, were brought into this place where this eunuch Hegai was there, caring for them and watching over them. And we know she was a beautiful, lovely and beautiful, it says here. Now there's if you've watched the movies, there's a few movies out there about Esther. One Night with the King, the Book of Esther, which I recommend, the Book of Esther. It's a great book. It's pretty biblical. You know, no movie is right on completely. You can forget about it. Hollywood, somehow, they still got to do a little twisting when they do movies. But the Book of Esther movie that comes in the 10-pack series, that's a really good movie of showing you. But they always show this Esther really as a beautiful woman. But I wanted you to understand this about who she was in verse 7. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. It means she was really pretty. She really was. She was a knockout. But if you look at that word and you look it up, it also meant she had a good character. She was joyful, kind, loving, and cheerful. In other words, she had a great personality on top of the looks. And when you put those two things together, you really have a nice girl. I know over the years, I would see these pretty girls. And when I look as a man, you know, you look and you go, man, that's a good girl. Nice looking girl. But then if you talk to them and all this effing, you know, man, that's like ugly. Now me, I've never been a smoker. I hated cigarettes because my mom got cancer. I just hated them. I couldn't stand them. When I see a girl who looks pretty, I think, man, she's pretty. And then I see a cigarette, all of a sudden, she just becomes totally ugly to me. Even though her beauty's there, it just changes her whole features for me. It just does that. Esther was a girl who was beautiful and had a great personality. Joyful, kind, loving. You ever meet someone like that? Great personality. You know, you could be ugly and have a great personality and you look just as great. Even if you didn't have good features. A great personality is what people look for. Honestly, I know this culture thinks it's all about beauty and the products and all this stuff, but I've talked to a lot of women and girls who say they're not looking for really the handsome guy. They're looking for the guy who's kind, sweet, sensitive, and all this thing. Now, there is some, you know, they like the bad guy. some reason, some girls want the bad boy. You know, that's what I was. I was a bad boy. And girls, for some reason, I don't know what's wrong with their head, they just want the bad guy. They think something about him being tough is exciting until they got him. And then it's not so exciting no more, is it? They're usually abusive. They're womenizers. They belittle. They're control freaks. They're just not good guys. But for some reason, there's that appeal. But really, when you talk to girls, when they look, they really want the guy who's sensitive, caring, and loving, is going to nurture and care for them. That's what they really want. And their looks don't really have a whole lot to do with it. Our society tries to make it seem that way, but that's not true. Well, Esther was good-looking, joyful, kind, loving, and cheerful. Go down to verse 9. She's in the custody of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, pleased Hegai, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparation to her, besides her allowance. In other words, he was giving her more than what everyone was getting. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants into the best place in the house of the women. In other words, Hegai took special interest in Esther. Why? Because there was something about her that made him think, this is a good girl. This is one I think the king would really like. And really, Hegai sees something in Esther that he wants to put special attention on her. And you know, I often totally believe that when God wants something done for his will, he will put people in our lives that will give us special interest, whether it's at work, whether it's wherever. He will put somebody in your life that will take special care and special interest of you in order to, for God to accomplish his plan. And that's what's happening here with Esther. Hegai sees it and he wants to do something special. How do we know that? Because Potiphar took special interest with Joseph, remember? Joseph was captive. All these things were happening in his life. Potiphar's wife lying. And yet Potiphar had a special interest in Joseph. And that special interest, Joseph became the main guy in Potiphar's house. And then even when his wife made the accusation of him trying to rape her, he puts them in jail, but this is part of the plan of God for Potiphar to be there, or Joseph to be there, because ultimately he'd have to go to the king, and ultimately he would bring Israel, his father Jacob, and their family that are going to be starving into a place where he would spare them. Potiphar was used as a special person for Joseph. The same thing happened with Daniel in the lion's den in Babylon. The king took special interest of Daniel. Made him in charge of things. Daniel had dreams, and that special interest is what helped Daniel in his vision that God had for him. And here we see the same thing with Hegai with Esther. So we know this happens. We know God will bring people into your life to cause something to take place to accomplish his plan. And so Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal them. Remember, Esther's a Jew. Mordecai is a Jew. But they didn't tell nobody. Now, I believe they weren't really serving God. I believe there was still some anger towards the Jew at this time. And Mordecai just tells Esther when she goes, don't tell them your nationality. Your name is no longer Hadassah, but Esther, a Greek name. Making them think she was possibly Persian or Greek or something in that area, but not a Jew. We're not told why he told her this. We're not told that there was some great plan that was revealed to him, and possibly it could have been for their own safety. We're just told that he told her not to do this, and we know later this will come in handy. But see, God knew all this was happening, and God knew what was going to take place. Because God had a plan to spare his people. And so sometimes, you know, we think things work out one way and we don't understand. It's because God has another way of doing things. He even says, my ways are not your ways. And his ways often are different than the way we would think of something. I mean, I always think about things that happened to me and why they've happened to me. Or things that have happened to people, and you want to console and you want to comfort, and you think, how do you say something? And sometimes you just don't know. And yet God is just there the whole time. Somebody loses their job and you're trying to comfort them and help them, but you know what? God might have wanted them to lose that job because he needs them over here. They had to lose their job. They had to be taken captive like Esther because he's trying to get them to another location. I think about that with churches. I've been involved with churches for 28 years now, and I've watched people come and go. I've watched people go from one church to another church. I watched church hopping. It looked like a game almost, you know, going around the merry-go-round, find out where can you land. And that can be ridiculous. But honestly, sometimes God doesn't want you in the church you're at. He wants to take you somewhere else. You're done here. He wants to take you there now. Not all the time, but sometimes this is very true. He has a way of moving us for his plan, not our plan, his plan. And we have to be sensitive to that and understand that and know that God's in charge and he knows how to make it all happen. We don't. We just think we know the plan. Well, they didn't know. And he just told her, don't mention that you're a Jew. And Esther didn't do this. Verse 11, And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations of the women, or for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months of oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Now, we already know these are good-looking women to begin with. And now they're going to go to a beauty salon for a whole year. I mean, can you think of that? One whole year. The other day I was telling my wife, I think I'm going to go get a pedicure. And she looked at me, what? Huh? Oh. No wonder why she looked at me. Now I know why she looked at me. A manicure. I saw a guy on TV, Steve McGarrett, and he was getting his fingers done. I thought, is it wrong for a guy to get that done? You know, I don't work on cars anymore. My fingers aren't black anymore, and it would be kind of nice to have them looking. You know, I look at them all the time, but I just thinking about that. But and plus, because I'm reading this, I mean. Hey, wait a minute. You girls get to go all the time. Paint the toes, paint whatever. Why can't we go have our nails done and cleaned up a little bit and the dead skin taken off? You know? So I'm going, man, 6 months of myrrh that she, oil of myrrh. Oil of myrrh comes from the trees known in Africa and Asia. For 6 months, they're being, it says, preparation, it means that they were being purified, being prepared. Can you imagine today your wife saying, honey, I'm going to the beauty shop, I'll be back in a while, and she don't show up for a year? But then when she comes back, man, she's just knocked out gorgeous. Just one whole year gone. And all this is done, notice, for one time with the king. For just one time with the king. Now, you can't look at that and say Ahasuerus is really a nice guy. He's really a sex maniac is what he is. And all this is taking place so that he can have one night with a virgin. That's what it's all about. He's not the greatest guy, not the greatest example. But this is what this story is about here. And thus, verse 13, prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. You know, I was reading some of the culture history of this whole thing, and a lot of girls wanted this. They weren't afraid to do this. They wanted this. Because they were taken care of the rest of their lives. They were provided for like no other. They weren't living in the neighborhoods of Persia and struggling to get things along. They were being well cared for. So there was a desire to do this. He said, in the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shegagaz, I think that's how you pronounce it, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So now she's a part of the harem. And the harem would have, typically it's the wives, the concubines, the ones that he didn't marry. He'd married a lot of women, but if they didn't marry them, they were called concubines or mistresses. Some say they had family women and wives that were a part of this harem. They're not sure about this harem, but nonetheless, the idea was that there was a whole group of women that were being cared for in the second home. And these women couldn't get married to anyone. They now belong to the king. So after that first night, they would have no husband, and they would never have any type of pleasure with the man ever again unless the king called for them. But yet they were taken care of, and they lived together in this second house. All these women living together. Can you imagine the boredom of all that? And can you imagine thinking, all this because I'm really pretty? Changes the whole idea of being beautiful. Because for them, beauty would become really, I would think, a curse. Yes, they're being provided for. Yes, they're in this house with the king. And yes, they get the fame of, I was with the king. But then they never marry. They can never have children unless he called for them and wanted them. Never. This is part of the curse of this whole ordeal here. And so, after, unless he called for them, they would not come. David and Solomon in Scripture says they both had wives and concubines. It wasn't just a Gentile king, even the kings of Israel. We know that Solomon, according to the book of Kings, says he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He's a sick guy. I can't imagine having that many women in my life. I just can't. I mean, before I got saved, when you're a guy, you're trying to get all you can. But really, once you get married and you get your senses back to you, man, it's worth doing one, man. Both ways. It can be really work. Can you imagine 700 plus 300 concubines? That's crazy. But that's what Solomon had according to the book of Kings. We know that this is what he had. And they all belonged to him. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Now, this gives us the impression that Esther, too, thought it was okay to go to the king, because she knew that Haggai was someone she could trust. Now, all the women could pick whatever they want, meaning of the royal jewels of the harem. They could pick whatever they want and go before the king and display themselves. But we're told here, Esther, what she did, she went to Haggai and asked him, what should I do? Now, who knew the king better than Haggai? He was the closest eunuch to the king. No one did like Haggai. Esther was smart enough to say, tell me what I need to do. Show me what I need to do when I come into this man's presence. And we're told that Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Everyone who looked at her saw how beautiful she was. But if I go back to the definition of beauty and lovely, I think when they talked with her and saw her, they saw beyond that beauty. That this was a person of loyalty, joy, and kindness, and goodness. And they saw this in her like no other woman that they had seen before. All who saw her thought she was great. We're told in 1 Peter chapter 3 for women, it's not the adorning of the outside, the perfumes and jewelry that you should be concerned about, but the inner part of the heart of the woman that should be displayed. She had that. She had natural beauty, but she also had that hidden heart beauty that really, if you're a guy, that's what you're looking for, is that inner heart of a woman. You know, not one that's nagging, not one that's criticizing, not one that's putting down their husband. I'm telling you, today it's so tough not to put down your husband. If you watch a lot of secular TV and you're watching along with the wrong stuff, you are going to put down your husband. Because that's all the shows teach us today, is to put down the husband. And then we say, why are our kids messed up? Why is our society messed up? And I'm telling you, I hear it all the time, even within the church. It's a lot of gender stuff. If men would just do this, if men would just do that, if the women would just do this, and the women would just do that. And I'm like, man, it's not about gender. We are a fallen, sinful people. And we need a relationship with God and get past the gender part. Let's just seek God. But you start watching these shows that are putting down the husbands, and the husbands are the ones that are supposed to be the heads of the houses, shown the respect so that they can nurture and care for their kids, but they're being put down and stepped on, and then the wife is stepping on them, or the families are stepping on them. Not a wonder we don't have problems in our homes. It's not a wonder that our kids are disobedient and are confused. It's not a wonder the man doesn't want to step up and be a man anymore. Just let the wife do it all now. So now he's relinquished his responsibility that God has given him. We need to be encouraged and strengthened and allow God to use us as the way he designed us to be used, to nurture and care for our families, to lead our families, to be the examples to our families. And again, last week we talked about, you know, Adam and Eve. Eve was to be by the side, not behind or in front or to step on, but by the side, side by side, we would care for our families. Side by side. But our culture is bringing that separation, and women's lib is saying, you don't need a man, you can do it yourself. We're all messed up. We need to be the people that are worshiping and serving God. And we don't need all these relationships. And you know what's going on today? By the time a teenager gets married, they've already been through how many relationships? Statistics say between 5 and 10 relationships before they ever get married. Our young girls, our young boys, by the time they get married, they're not virgins anymore like here. They've been misused. They've been fooled. They think they're in love. But Daddy, I love them. That's not love. That's lust. And I say it even with our kids here today, because if we don't, they're going to find it the other way. And telling you, the other way is not working. It's just not working. Too many teenage pregnancies. Too many people having to go to, you know, PRC to get an ultrasound, which they should go if they are, but there's just too many. There's just too many girls that are have been fooled and abused and used. And I don't know the number of guys that end up splitting once they find out the girls is pregnant, but I know it's high. And then they're the ones left to raise these children. All because a man wants to do what a man wants to do. And here in this case, this man just wanted the girls and didn't care. We need to teach our children what real purity is about. Like Esther, you might be beautiful, but the heart needs to be conditioned as well. Now, when the turn of Esther came, the daughter, we read that Esther obtained favor in all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tibet, and in the 7th year of his reign. So this is, again, the 7th year of his reign is 4 years after. Remember chapter 1, verse 3, it was the 3rd year of Ahasuerus' reign when he had this party, or the 6 months of displaying his wealth, and all the leaders were there. The 3rd year. Now we're at the 7th year, and Esther hasn't even become queen yet, so 4 years has passed. And then we're told the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Esther is the one chosen. Esther is picked to become the new queen. And it says here that the king loved Esther. It doesn't mean he fell in love with Esther. Okay? Don't think that. What it means in the Hebrew, this word love means that he had affection for, or he liked her, and this is what he saw in her, and there was this attraction to him that he liked her more than all the rest. In fact, let me read you what the NIV and how it puts it. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women. Attracted to her. Not in love with her. He was just attracted to her. Personally, I would think if I go back to love and beautiful, meaning not just pretty, but kind, joyful, sweet, all these things, cheerful, that as he spent time with her and talked with her, he saw the inside of this woman, not just the outside. And this is what drew him and attracted him. Think of when you first were attracted to your husband or to your wife. What brought you to that place? Now, of course, if you looked and you thought, ooh, yeah, nice. You know, that was an attraction. But once you started talking, there was something else deeper. Their mannerisms, the way they talked, the way they presented themselves, the way they cared for you. There are things that, you know, especially if you're a man, that we do, you know, sometimes for the hunt. And then there's things we do because it's who we are on the inside. And the woman can see that inside, and they recognize true beauty. For us guys, it's a little harder. We have to really look to see the inside of a woman, the real beauty of a woman. But there's something there that really draws us. And that's what this word means here when it talks about love. There was an affection. Something was drawing him. And he decided, she's the one I want to spend time with. She's the one that it's almost like for him, this is more than just sexual pleasure. There's actually someone here who's intelligent and can communicate and can talk, and we can have joy and a time together. And he decides to make her queen. Verse 18, then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the province and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. So he makes a holiday for Esther becoming queen. And instead of this wedding where we come and present presents to the bride and groom, the king gives presents to all the people who attend. Now, how would you like to go a wedding like that? Don't bring nothing. We're going to give you presents. Can you imagine? I mean, he had so much wealth. He was blessing everyone else. And then he makes a holiday based upon what had happened to show the people that she's the queen. And they say, part of the holiday, the blessing was he lowered the taxes. I mean, for us, that would be awesome. Just to lower the taxes, man. And he did things for them according to his generosity. Verse 19, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. So here's the second bringing of the harem. Again, the women are still coming. And it says that Mordecai sat within the king's gate. The king's gate is equivalent to like a law court. That's where all the official business was done, was at the gates of the city. People would come, mostly the common people would come, and if there was a dispute, remember Solomon would be at the gate, they would do this thing. Ahasuerus, I think it's Ahasuerus, who took over David, he went to the king's gate and started to answer the questions for the people, and he started to get the people's heart so he could overtake his father's kingdom. And this is the gate where Mordecai, it seems he's now promoted to this area of the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. This verse spoke to me because it reminds me of the responsibility of training our children. Here's Mordecai, her older cousin, now father. And Mordecai trained her and taught her in such a way that when she was a young girl, we don't know what age, 16, 17, 18, somewhere in that area. When she was a young girl, and though she was taken into the king's court, she had obeyed her stepfather, who had trained her and taught her to respect him. And there was a relationship between her and him, such a way that she listened to him and did what he said. And you know, raising kids can be a difficult and demanding job, especially to train them. Now, when they're little, they're going to do all kinds of things. All kinds of things to tick you off, cause you to lose your patience and your temper. They're going to do all kinds of stuff. But, you know, we have to take the time to keep training them, and we're going to blow it. It just happens. But eventually, as we keep investing in our kids and showing them, they're going to grow up to be, they should grow up. They should grow up to be respectful kids to their parents, especially their father. And I know this because I can remember how many girls had bad father's relationship. And you know what girls with bad father relationships do when they get bigger? You know, huh? They find a guy who's got a bad relationship and end up with the same kind of guy. Girls need to have a good relationship with their father so they can find a guy who has a good relationship with them also. Esther was taught by Mordecai honor and respect, that even at this age she obeyed him and did what he said by not revealing who she was. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigtha and Teresh, doorkeepers, or you could put bodyguards, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. What he became furious, we don't know. Maybe he was mad because they took Vashti out and brought Esther in. Maybe they knew she was Jew. We don't know. They were just mad that they had planned to assassinate the king. While Mordecai is now promoted as a judge at the gate, he hears this private conversation, because he's at the gate. He hears their plan and to kill them. And you know, when I think about this, Mordecai was at the right place at the right time. He was at the right place at the right time. And can you see God moving? That he had him promoted at a specific time to be there at a specific time, so that when these guys are planning to assassinate the king, he overhears it. And what does he do with the information that he gets? So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. He didn't keep it to himself. He went and told his cousin. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now notice, Esther didn't come off like she found out. She told him who said this. This is my cousin, my father. He heard this, and she tells King Ahasuerus. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hung on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, a couple of researchy things said, when they talk about hung on the gallows, it didn't just mean they were hung, it means that the blood was completely emptied out of their body as they hung there. And what we don't read is that what we do read is Mordecai basically stopped the plan of assassination of King Ahasuerus. What we don't read is that even though he was given credit for it by Esther to the king never did nothing. Never said, thank you. Thank you for sparing my life or capturing the guy. He never rewarded Mordecai for his actions until later. Again, the hand of God. You know, you do something now at your work or within your family or wherever, and you don't get the reward, you don't get the promotion, you don't get what you think you're supposed to have. And then later, God opens another door of blessing because of that incident that happened, you know, 6 months ago or 2 months ago. Because he's got a divine plan for our lives. And he's got doors he wants to open for our lives later. Even though the incident might have happened here. How do we know this? Well, Joseph, again, remember the story of Joseph with the baker and the butler. When he's in prison and they come and they reveal the dreams and this whole thing, and Joseph tells them, and when they leave and call back by the king, he says, hey, remember me. Remember that I told you guys this dream. And in the book it says there in Genesis 40:23 that it was 2 years later when the butler said, oh yeah, you know what? There's a guy in jail who told me dreams. He had forgotten for 2 whole years to give Joseph the credit. But then when God needed Joseph to step up and be the man that he would become, second place in all of the kingdom of Babylon, in order to spare the new nation as developing of 70 people with his father and brothers and their wives and children, God brought him up to this place right when he needed him to be there. And this is the same thing that will happen to Mordecai. Because you see, God never forgets what we do. Hebrews 6:10 says, for God is not unjust to forget your work and labors of love. God doesn't forget our actions. He doesn't forget the things we've done. He knows everything that's happening to us. And he knows what has to happen when he's with us. Mordecai, when you think of who he was and what he did, he was used by God to accomplish God's will when God needed it done. And I put, he was at the right place at the right time. Now, do you believe that about your lives? That God has you at the right place at the right time for something that might take place later? Whatever that place may be, wherever it might be, the job, it might be, you know, if you're single and you're trying to figure out, why am I over here? And then you bump into the guy who's going to be your husband or your wife. We just don't know. We let God do it even when we don't see it. I don't understand. I don't see God. I don't hear God. But he's still there. He's still working. He's still doing what he has to do. And I'm going to close with this story about my grandma's death. It's a little bit like this, but this is what I remember about being at the right place at the right time. When my grandma passed away and we went back to California to go to her funeral, my cousin needed pan dulce, that's sweet bread or Mexican bread, pastries. And so I went to the Mexican store, and me and Gina and David, they were little. And we go there and we're at the light. And if I remember, it was me, a car in front of me, this car and, or a van, me, the car in front of me, the van, and this car. And I've ridden Harley for tons of years. So I'm always scanning, always. That's the way I drive. I scan because of being on a bike for so long. I have to keep my head above me. I have to look two cars ahead, see what's going on to make sure I don't hit a kid coming out of a driveway or a dog or something. So I'm always scanning. And I see the lights going to turn, and I see this guy coming on a bike down the street. And the van's here, and the car in front of me is here, and here's me, and we're going. And I'm looking, and I go, oh my gosh, this guy is not going to see that guy on that bike. That van is too big, obstructing his view. And I thought, oh man, we're going to see an accident. I just knew it. Sure enough, man, the guy swerves around the van, the car hits him, the guy flies over the car and into the ditch in the railroad tracks. And I'm looking and going, oh my gosh, I don't believe it. Saw the whole thing in front of me. First time I actually just saw the events take place. We go past the light, go, man, I should stop. Gina and David, no, Dad, don't stop, don't stop. I go, no, I need to stop. And so I went to the Mexican store and I bought the pandusa, and the whole time I'm thinking, man, I should have stopped. So we get out, you know, 15, 20 minutes is coming. We're going to our car, and I see the guy there, and it happens to be a Japanese guy. And there's the cops, and I'm slowly, you know, I'm thinking, man, what do I do? And I'm going over, and the Japanese guy can't talk very good English at all. And the cops having trouble understanding him. Finally, I just go over there, and I said, you know what, officer? I saw the whole accident. And he said, well, they're telling us that this guy hit the guy. I said, but that's not what happened. He hit him, but this guy, and I tell him the whole story. And he said, oh, well, that's different than what we're thinking. And the guy just reaches into his pocket, and he says, here, thank you, thank you, thank you. I said, no, no, I don't need nothing. No, 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 thank you, thank you, thank you. And we said, okay, you know, whatever. I just stuck the money in my pocket, and we left. And, of course, I got curious afterwards, so I pulled the money out, and it was three $100 bills. And I thought, oh, my gosh, Lord, that's just totally unbelievable. Of course, I didn't do it for the money. It was good that I went back because I was there at the right time, because they would have got him for hitting this guy when it wasn't his fault. And I'll never forget that, being there at the right time for the right reason. And sometimes we're doing stuff and we're there at the right time for the right reason, because God had a plan. In that incident, for me, it was to be a witness for this guy who couldn't speak good English to communicate to the cop what had happened, because everybody left, myself included. Man, I'm just as guilty, but there was something that told me to go back because the store was right across the street right there. And if we just let God do what he's going to do and pay attention, maybe you'll be at the right place at the right time for the behalf of somebody else. Amen. Father, we thank you for your word this morning and for what you say to us, Lord. And Lord, it's good to know that you are in charge. It's good to know that you have the events planned out, and there are times when we truly will be at the right place for the right time. Because you have a plan for our lives, and you have a plan for other people's lives, and sometimes our lives intertwine together, and there's purposes involved, Lord. And we might not see you. We think, what happened? But you're there. You're orchestrating, you're maneuvering, you're allowing things to take place because you have plans, Lord. And we are so grateful that your plan often includes us. And how we pray for a blessing upon our lives and our children's lives, and how we can be better fathers and better mothers, and we can nurture and train our children as Mordecai did Esther, Lord. And how we can be available as Mordecai, just sitting at the gate, judging things and overhearing and recognizing an evil that will be committed and bringing it forth, announcing it to others who need to know, Lord. We're so grateful, Father God, that you give us instruction and that you help us through your word to live the life you've called us to live, Lord. And even though we might not see you, you're still there. Even though we can't explain why the job has done this or the something's going on here, you're still there. You're still working, Lord. You're still letting things happen according to your will, for your purposes, Lord. So we bless you for your word this morning, and we thank you, Father God. And Lord, how we know Jesus came at the right time for the right reason, that our lives would be restored to you as our Heavenly Father. And so we thank you for what Jesus did too, Lord. Amen.